The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform. You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 3rd of July 2020 on Monocle 24. The Briefing is brought to you in association with Allianz.
As part of the programme's partnership with Allianz, we are bringing you stories that demonstrate Allianz's commitment to securing people's lives. After all, for 130 years all around the globe, Allianz has been working hard to do just that, to give courage to its customers for what's ahead. Because Allianz knows how important it is to have a fair partner at your side who provides solid and sustainable solutions. Allianz strives to do it right, with passion, every day. Stay tuned to The Briefing to hear exactly how Allianz does it. An Allianz for life.
Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up, France's Prime Minister Edouard Philippe has resigned. We'll ask what it means for the country. Plus, Monocle's US election correspondent Thomas Lewis will have an update on the race for the White House. And a little later,
I'm Monocle's correspondent in Rio, Lucinda Elliott, and I'll be taking a tour of the South American Mercosur bloc with our in-house culture correspondent Fernando, where we assess who is faring best when it comes to the COVID fallout.
Thanks very much, Lucinda. Then we'll be finding out how some of London's and Monocle's favourite restaurants are faring ahead of this weekend's grand opening.
To keep the distancing and keep the safety of people, I'm installing some panels and I'm about to demolish a counter just to make it a business or something that you can trade again.
All that and more besides ahead here on The Briefing with me, Tom Edwards. We begin today's programme with the news that the French Prime Minister Edouard Philippe has resigned. Let's get the latest now with Monocle's Paris correspondent Tom Burgess Watson. Good afternoon to you, Tom. Great to hear from you. Tell us what exactly has happened.
Well, this isn't entirely unexpected. Last month, President Emmanuel Macron said he wanted to reinvent his presidency. He's had this prime minister at his side since the beginning, Edouard Philippe, who's been consistently popular. And presidents here in France don't necessarily like prime ministers that outshine them. And I think the question with 21 months looming until the next presidential elections is Edouard Philippe the right running mate? So that, I think, is the logic behind this. And what I think has really been a catalyst for a rethink about what to do, because President Macron's party, La République En Marche, had an extremely poor performance. It was a great performance, on the other hand, for the Green parties and the left-leaning allies of the Green parties. So I think, you know, President Macron has been under considerable pressure to reboost his Green credentials, have a big rethink about his party and what it stands for. And we're expecting a new prime minister to be announced within the next few hours and a reshuffled government to be unveiled by at the very latest the middle of next week.
Well, Tom, can you give us some sense of exactly how big a political gamble it might be for Macron to replace Philippe? Because as you said, he's more popular. Philippe's numbers are definitely better than Macron's. And yet, as you say, this was a sort of telegraphed reshuffle anyway. Is it risky for him politically, for Macron?
Yeah, well, you're right to point out the approval rating. President Macron's approval rating has been recently below the 40% mark. And Edouard Philippe, his prime minister's rating, has been quite a lot higher than that. So again, another example of the prime minister outshining the president. And this is a gamble because Yes, President Macron is internationally quite well respected in certain quarters. He's seen as a decisive, strong European leader who's got good ideas for this country. But domestically, he has struggled. The pandemic has obviously been painful for many countries, France by no means an exception. But prior to the pandemic, there were months of these yellow vest protests, highly unpopular labour reforms, which seen from the outside look extremely necessary. But if you're a victim of them, you're certainly not going to vote for a president who's done that to you. So there's been quite a considerable amount of unrest these last few months, and actually really the last couple of years of French politics have been fairly tumultuous. So yes, there is the question of who is going to replace Edouard Philippe. And there are people saying that it could be Edouard Philippe himself. It isn't unheard of for a prime minister who has resigned to be then replaced by himself. It might sound extraordinary, but it has happened before. And there's a list of people, you know, out there as to who the next prime minister might be. But there is this other risk that Edouard Philippe might end up being a challenger to President Macron, because after all, as we've been saying, he's seen as a competent pair of hands, he's popular, and he just was the only success point in the municipal elections of last weekend. He won the seat as the mayor of Le Havre. So that was one of the few bright spots in what was a pretty dark electoral weekend for President Macron's party.
Tom Burgess-Watson, always great to hear from you. Thanks for bringing us up to speed from Paris with the latest. You're listening to The Briefing here on Monocle 24. Let's get the latest on the US election now. It's just months away, of course. Who better to guide us than our election correspondent? That's Thomas Lewis, and he joins us now. Good afternoon from here. Good morning to you, Thomas. How do we find you today?
A little bleary-eyed, Tom. It is bright and early here, but the sun is shining, and you, of course, are always a ray of sunshine, Tom, speaking to you. So, yes, not too bad. Could be worse.
You sound surprisingly chipper. You're not really a morning person, but this is not what we're here to talk about. Let's talk, first of all, Thomas, about fundraising. It's critical, of course, in any campaign, this one no different. Tell us a bit about how these two contestants are measuring up in that department.
Well, you're right to say, Tom, that fundraising, you know, despite what, say, a gaffe or putting a foot wrong that any presidential candidate puts, that if behind the scenes the money in the war chest is robust, then perhaps those are storms that either candidate can weather. And it's been a big week in fundraising terms for Joe Biden. It was announced this week for the second straight month that he has managed to out-fundraise President Donald Trump. If we just rewind just a few short months back to the start of the year, one of the big doubts, if you like, over the viability of Joe Biden's candidacy, if you remember, he had a big defeat at the Iowa caucuses and also later in New Hampshire in the primaries there, that the money just wasn't coming in. And Donald Trump's campaign was raising a huge amount of money. Now, Joe Biden has overpassed him by a small number, relatively speaking, in these terms, given that the numbers raised for presidential campaigns are absolutely vast by many standards. So I think what we're seeing is that, for example, the bedrock of Donald Trump's campaign donations appear to be from fairly big money donors, whereas it appears that Joe Biden's donations are coming in much smaller sizes from individual donors. I think that could be significant as we go forward, given that Donald Trump is really trying to keep his base, which, of course, many would argue wasn't necessarily the majority of voters back in 2016, and that Joe Biden will hope to prove that by getting smaller donors from a broader array, a broader swathe, if you like, of the American electorate, that actually that will give him a better chance of winning and bringing people together on election day in this extraordinary time in the United States.
Well, Thomas, let's do another little compare and contrast between the two candidates and talk about rallying. This is also really important. Lots of coverage, of course, of Trump's recent endeavours to get people together, despite warnings from many, including the scientific community, not to congregate in numbers because of COVID-19. Biden's now said he just won't be doing in-person rallies. How do they measure up in this other crucial theatre?
Well, Donald Trump is still fairly stung, so the report suggests, from the lower than expected turnout at his big return to the rallying landscape, if you like, in Tulsa in Oklahoma. That event, of course, was hugely controversial in many respects, given that in Oklahoma the numbers of coronavirus infections were rising at the time, and given that Donald Trump had asked those attending the rallies he hadn't mandated them wearing masks, and he'd also asked them to sign a waiver stating that if they did get unwell following their attendance, they wouldn't hold the Trump campaign accountable, which is still fairly extraordinary. To my mind, apparently the Trump campaign is recalibrating on how the rallies will fit into his campaign strategy now, given they really were the sort of central pillar, I think. You know, he isn't one for policy details. He isn't one for getting deep into the weeds of a political issue. And the rallies were a very effective way of whipping up the crowd, of broadcasting those pictures and making people feel that the support behind him was really this raucous, rowdy, loud and perhaps insurmountable thing come election day. That doesn't appear to be the case in terms of the optics, at least. Now, I think Joe Biden again has tried to take the lead here to be kind of the adult in the room and just say, look, we just cannot convincingly, responsibly or safely bring huge numbers of people together, no matter how attractive a prospect they are, when you are pushing your campaign and the enthusiasm around it to a wider audience. Joe Biden, of course, has had to run a large amount of his campaign throughout the height of the lockdown in the US from the basement in his home in Delaware. That appears to have done him some favours, in fact, given that he isn't the kind of candidate that people are wildly enthusiastic about. But in terms of the idea of being a safe pair of hands, someone who can be trusted, a quiet adult voice in the room, then that appears to have worked for him. So again, as you say, Tom, it is again becoming quite a clear contrast between the two candidates on yet another issue here.
Well, you mentioned optics there, Thomas, and just finally, I wanted to ask about a couple of other things which are sort of partly visual in character almost. That's wearing masks, which is always interesting, but also the optics of other races that are going on. I know in Kentucky, there's been the Senate race, which is kind of instructive if we look at these battles between progressives and centrists and radicals. How helpful is it to look at some of these other issues and see if that can tell us anything about how November might go?
Well, to start with the masks issue, again, it's a little similar to the rallies. As soon as Joe Biden, for example, made his first public appearance after lockdown was eased in Delaware on Memorial Day, he paid tribute at a war memorial in Delaware. He was wearing a mask. Donald Trump made great fun of him, stating that it was a symbol of his weakness, of his age, of his frailty. But he has insisted on wearing a mask ever since, leading by example, if you like, saying to prospective voters, well, look, if we're asking you to wear masks and wear masks you should, then I am going to wear them alongside you. There is pressure mounting on Donald Trump to do so. We have seen that he, perhaps the corners of vanity, if you like, of his personality, of his campaign, have made him reticent to do so. At a manufacturing plant in Michigan a couple of months ago, he effectively said that he didn't want to give the press the pleasure of photographing him wearing a mask, which I think gives the impression that he's slightly more concerned about how he looks than the medical and safety things that wearing a mask are essential to avoid at the moment. And yes, just briefly, Tom, if you look at other races, we have had some results from primaries that took place a week ago this week. And they do make for really fascinating reading, because within the Democrats, of course, there is a big battle, a big conversation shaping up between more centrist, more moderate candidates, which is the camp Joe Biden represents, but also the more progressive wing, which is, of course, what, say, Senators Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, former presidential candidates, the platform they were running on. So in Kentucky is a big one. Amy McGrath, she is a former Marine fighter pilot. She had a huge war chest, much bigger than usually a Senate campaign would be able to amass. She was given a very real challenge by a more progressive candidate, a state representative, Charles Booker, who really ascended in the last few weeks of the campaign following the big anti-police bias and the Black Lives Matter protests in Kentucky. She managed to sneak a victory. And in Colorado, too, John Hickenlooper, who is a very popular centrist politician. He ran for president himself earlier this year briefly. He also won. So we are seeing this kind of battle shaping up in the list of candidates various corners of the Democratic Party across the country are choosing. And I think that could make for a really interesting race for the Democrats. There are many people who like to describe it as the end of the Democratic Party, but I think many people would say if these candidates do rise to the top, if a progressive loses to a centrist or vice versa, then that is voters having their say, and that can be no bad thing.
Thomas, thanks so much for the update. Great to hear from you. That was our US election correspondent, Thomas Lewis. Plenty more coming from him in the next few days here on Monocle 24. You're with The Briefing. Leaders in Argentina and Brazil have been holding talks this week in a bid to curb the spread of coronavirus. It's the first time the region's two biggest economies have spoken to each other since the start of the pandemic. Well, let's get more on this now with Monocle 24's resident expert on Brazilian politics, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, who's here in studio with me, and our Latin America affairs correspondent, Lucinda Elliott, who joins us on the line from Rio. Fernando, I'll come to you first of all. These are two countries who've responded very differently to the pandemic, of course. Tell us, I guess, from the Brazilian point of view, how this meeting went.
Well, I'm not sure if the meeting went well, Tom, but certainly it was not as bad as expected. The interesting thing here that Jair Bolsonaro and Alberto Fernandes, you know, they never met since Alberto Fernandes was elected, which is quite shocking, really, for two countries that are so closed economically and even physically, they are neighboring countries. And again, even in the meeting, Lucinda will talk more about the Argentine reaction. But it's interesting how Bolsonaro avoided mentioning the word COVID-19 at all costs. It seems that he was worried about attracting investment to the country. He said that he wanted to change the negative perception that Brazil is having outside, not only because of COVID-19, but because of deforestation. And again, it was a virtual meeting, and they didn't have to really to interact that much with each other. Clearly, there's a dislike there. I mean, in the Argentine campaign, Bolsonaro supported Macri. I think they've exchanged a few heated words. But I think here, Alberto Fernandes is the more conciliatory one, if I may say that as well.
I think by some margin, Fernando. Well, listen, let me bring you in then on exactly that point which Fernando set up there. The Argentine response, what have you made of that? What have people been saying in the Argentine press, for example, about this meeting and what it did or didn't achieve?
Yeah, I mean, I think the meeting this week, Fernandes, he said that he didn't need to act like the other members when it came to his virus strategy, which was a clear nod to Brazil. But again, as Fernando says, he didn't specifically mention Bolsonaro. I think there's an awful lot, as Fernando mentioned, the trade between the two is particularly important. And I'd argue that Argentina is in the weaker position when it comes to all of this, because what we have more than 3 months on since the outbreak are some chronic economic issues in Argentina. And these are built around a history of debt defaults and mismanagement. And once again, Argentina during this period has not managed to meet a repayment deadline, potentially locking it out of international borrowing markets. And Argentina, let's remember, was loaned one of the biggest sums in the history of the IMF back in 2017, a record $57 billion. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, Fernandes has been leading on this wave of popularity at home, but he may see that his ratings start to decline as the country enters default and as this economic mess ensues. So I could see why he was taking a slightly calmer response during the meeting.
And Lucinda, just on the sort of broader pan-regional picture, there are other players here, of course, the likes of Uruguay, sort of squeezed in between the two powerhouses. Is there a sort of, I don't know, a collateral damage exactly, but, you know, does the decisions, the ramifications of policy in Brazil and, of course, and in Buenos Aires, does that directly affect the likes of Uruguay?
Yeah, I mean, Uruguay does rely heavily on tourism from abroad, particularly from Argentina. So the closure of its borders and that of Argentina is of concern, and both the economic downturns in the neighbouring countries, Brazil and Argentina. Uruguayans, myself included, I'm a dual national, although I'm here in Brazil, they can travel to the EU. It's been one of the only countries in the South America region that can. And that is because they have less than 1,000 confirmed cases. As of yesterday, they only had 28 deaths. You know, it is a minute country. The capital, Montevideo, there had a very serious lockdown, but I would argue that the city isn't exactly a hub of bustling nightlife and activity on any normal week. So I would argue that, you know, it's been a slightly easier place for people to stay at home. But again, like Argentina, Uruguay elected a new president at the end of the last year. So he's actually the first head of state outside the left-wing Frente Amplio party for well over a decade. And so this, again, was a first meeting for him as well.
Well, let's maybe pivot, Fernando, to more of a domestic picture. And let's talk a little bit about Brazil. We've got municipal elections, of course, on the way. Is it inevitable that the management or mismanagement of the coronavirus pandemic within Brazil's borders informs all of the political decisions that lay Brazilians will be making?
Well, absolutely, Tom. In fact, I'm very, very curious about this year's elections. This week, in fact, the delay of the elections have been approved. They were supposed to happen in October. Now they're happening in November, on the 15th of November, the first round. And on a normal year, we would know more candidates by this stage. But I think there's so many things happening in Brazil by now. And let's remember, local elections in Brazil, I mean, we say local, but it's a huge election. Literally, more than 5,000 Brazilian cities will be electing their mayors. And I think we should definitely keep an eye on the bigger cities, which, you know, might have some implications for the presidential election 2 years after. Looking at São Paulo, we had a mayor called Bruno Covas. He was a bit lackluster at the beginning, but he had, you know, severe health problems, not related to COVID-19. In a way, I think he became slightly more likable. So he could be re-elected potentially. In Rio, again, Lucinda's living there. She might give an update on this, but Marcelo Crivella definitely didn't do a good administration. He is a bit of a populist. He was a former kind of ally of Bolsonaro, not anymore. And again, Tom, it would be very interesting to see who will be elected. Will the left do well in this election? I have a feeling that it might not do that well. I think the center-right parties are kind of more prepared electorally. But that doesn't mean that that's good for Bolsonaro as well, because Bolsonaro, again, he became kind of this figure who is supported by 33% of the population, but not really related to any political parties in special. I think it's more kind of a Bolsonaro movement, if I may say, not really a political party one. But again, it will be a very, very interesting election. But there is a lack of new names. I haven't been seeing that many, to be fair.
Well, Lucinda, very, very briefly then, just as Faye says there, you obviously sat in Rio. Is there one particular municipal or mayoral vote that we can really draw conclusions that could shape the next presidential election cycle? Or is it just too early and too complicated a picture to say that?
I think it's too complicated. I mean, quite honestly, there's so many corruption scandals that seem to sort of, you know, unveil every other day, it appears here. And one of the biggest arguments, and I would agree with Fernando, is that I think a big part of this is going to be the underlying, you know, economic message that some of these municipal governments can conjure up during this COVID outbreak, because here in the state of Rio, really, we're in a pretty bad state. I mean, the state is bankrupt. So, no, but for the moment, we don't have a clear face or a clear outline.
Lucinda in Rio, thank you. Fernando, before you leave us, you have a canine story for me. You have only 20 seconds, but tell me, what on earth is this about?
I know you love a good dog story. So basically this week, our first lady, Michelle Bolsonaro, she adopted apparently a street dog, and I'm doing quote marks here. But then even that, they are being unlucky this week, because in fact, it was a member of the Maremano Abruzzese sheepdog community, and he had an owner. But the funny thing is, the First Lady even gave him a name, Augusto Bolsonaro. You know, I am Fernando Augusto, so it was a bit strange that. And they had an Instagram page saying, oh, I love him, he's a new member of the family. But then the owner said, you know what, he has to return, and his name is not Augusto, it's Zeus, you know, that god.
Very distinguished. When things are not going your way, they're not going your way. Fernando, good to see you here in studio in London. This is The Briefing on Monocle 24, brought to you in association with Allianz.
The arrival of coronavirus left many countries lacking the healthcare facilities they needed to look after seriously ill patients. Allianz Spain, part of the world's largest insurer and asset manager, saw it as an opportunity to work with Barcelona-based startup Pretofi to generate easy-to-manufacture ventilators.
We were looking and discussing ways to help society, no, in these difficult circumstances, and Oxygen Project came to us. I saw it on TV news.
That was Monica González-Peñas, Market Management Director of Allianz Spain.
I was very surprised by how come a small startup has managed to design a ventilator very easy to produce in a car factory and get an agreement with Volkswagen Seat to produce it quickly to help hospitals in increase the capacity of helping people with COVID. So I talked to them and I say, okay, how Allianz can help you guys? Because I think that what you are doing is incredible.
Today, the project is already active in 50 countries. Intrigued? Well, you can hear stories like this here on the show every day, or read more in the Monocle Minute every morning. Or you can find out more anytime about building an Allianz for Life at allianz.com.
Finally on today's programme, England's hospitality sector is preparing for its grand reopening this weekend. Here's Monocle's contributing editor, Andrew Muller.
Tomorrow, July 4th, London's restaurants will be able to open properly for the first time in nearly 3 months. Nobody thinks it will be quite the same, but how different will it be? I went to visit a few. I started at Blandford's, a homely Italian diner on Chilton Street, just around the corner from Midori House. Because the food at Blandford's is great and the atmosphere always welcoming, Jessica, Blandford's owner, has come to know Monocle's crew well. Whatever the official reopening date she's been given, Jessica does not anticipate a return to actual normal occurring anytime soon.
The complete reopening and the feeling of a restaurant, the feeling back of a restaurant, I will say probably will be not just now, but maybe in the future, next year. My plan is to open from next week. I'm doing a bit of work at the restaurant, so I've had architects coming in to make some plans and see how much I can use the space that I've got, because it's quite small, the restaurant, and we had 8 tables before, and now it's going down to 4. And 5, putting the distance in of 1 meter and plus, which we don't know what is this plus, but to keep the distance in and keep the safety of people, I'm installing some panels, and I'm about to demolish a counter just to make it a business or something that you can trade again a bit more than nothing.
A short walk from Blandford's on Blandford Street in Marylebone is Jaconi, the acclaimed No Borders kitchen. Like all restaurants closed by COVID-19, Jaconi faced the challenge of keeping a close-knit team together during lockdown. Here's Jaconi's co-founder, Nadim Nanjuani.
I think the reason why a lot of us do this is because we live and breathe hospitality. We live and breathe face-to-face interactions. And a lot of the team here are people who love to be on their feet. They love to be moving between tables and making food and interacting. That was a tricky thing. It took us a few weeks to get our heads around it. And I think that we took a bit of an entrepreneurial approach to it. And we said, well, the world is having a moment here, and there is a lot of sorrow, there's a lot of pain going on. But what are the silver linings here?
Jaconi kept staff morale up with regular conference calls and discussion groups and launched a new takeaway brand. The restaurant has learned from recent months of uncertainty to be cautious.
And as business people, you like to think you can think your way out of a problem, and you actually, it was a good exercise in knowing how you compare to the rest of the world. You know, you're tiny in comparison, you can't really adapt to this situation. And even now, the situation is changing daily. So we're sitting here a few days before the 4th of July. We're hearing about what's happening in Leicester. We're watching what's happening on the beaches and around the city and feeling, okay, how do we come back safely for our guests? How do we come back safely for our team? Do we wait? Some restaurants are waiting. And we've decided to wait at least until next week. So we're not going to open this weekend. We just want to see what's happening, do some practice rehearsals without guests and things like that.
Which is not to say that there are no opportunities. Slightly further afield, on Brewer Street in Soho, the excellent Thai grill Kiln is also taking a wait-and-see approach with its main premises. They won't reopen there until July 24th, but they are opening elsewhere on July 11th. Here's Kiln's owner, Ben Chapman.
We're a company that's Kiln Smoking Goat and Bratz, Brat being a Basque grill in Shoreditch. And we are taking a space in Hackney called Clemson's Arch, which is Clemson's coffee roastery. And they have an large outdoors out the front. We're taking that space and opening an outdoors restaurant until September as Bratz, but staff from the surplus staff from the entire company. And our perspective on that is when faced with, you know, lower sales, we don't want to accept making people redundant. So what we can do about that is to open another restaurant. Now that seems fairly contrary to the mood of the moment, that's always our answer.
Chapman notes that for any restaurant, the logistics of reopening, refurbishing the premises, re-establishing relationships with suppliers, are not notably less daunting than starting afresh.
The significant challenges for us are supply chain based. We're so connected with the farms that we work with, a lot of the produce is grown specifically for our menu. So, I mean, even when we were opening here, we were working 6 months in advance in terms of supply chain. So that work is harder and involves risk for both parties. So managing that risk on both sides is tricky. In circumstances where neither party is operating a profit-making entity anymore, you know, those are difficult conversations.
It's not just restaurants that are going to have to relearn restauranting, however. So are their customers. Monocle's own cafe on Chilton Street has been open a few weeks now, but even London's best latte has taken a while to tempt people back. Here's Nadia from the cafe.
So at a time, we have to have one customer come inside the cafe in order to reduce contact with other people, just that it's safer for us, for the staff, and for like other people as well, so they don't have to come in contact with strangers that they don't know. A lot of people wear masks coming in, and we have hand sanitizers at the doors so that people can sanitize themselves. And when queuing outside, everyone has to stand 2 meters away from each other, which a lot of people have been keeping as a rule to stay away from each other, which is good. Yeah, and then obviously every like couple of hours we sanitize all the surfaces that customers might have touched.
It's going to be different for everybody, but for many of us, any relief from our own cooking is going to be better than none. Here's Nadim at Chicconi.
We are known for our homely hospitality. Chicconi means a kitchen, a home kitchen. So first of all, let's get the safety right. And then second of all, how do we bring our hospitality and our care and our charm back into that environment?
Yeah, that thing of trying to make it feel more like a restaurant and less like some sort of clinic, right?
That's exactly right. And how do you make a guest feel comfortable when you're standing 2 meters back? How do you make a guest feel comfortable when you're perhaps serving food on a tray next to their table and then stepping back and letting them put it onto their table? We have to make a bit of a song and a dance about it, or have a laugh about it with them, I think, and explain that, you know, this is actually being hospitable. Hospitality is about how we make you feel.
That was Nadim Nanjiani, ending that report by Andrew Muller. I'm joined now in the studio by another Andrew, our editor, Andrew Tuck. Several things strike me, Andrew, from that. The first being exactly that last point. Hospitality is about intimacy. It's about emotion. And with all of these clinical divisions between everyone, that's probably going to be the biggest challenge, no?
It's going to be tough when the waiter comes to your table and they're wearing a mask. You know, that bit of bonhomie that you get going during the evening, that's going to be trickier. But how fascinating listening to all those people, you know, everyone taking slightly different decisions, everyone incredibly entrepreneurial. Even as we said, Il Blanford's, our local cafe, Jessica, they're rebuilding inside the cafe to make it more viable. And when you think you're going to be down to four tables, how you generate profit is going to be super tricky. So lots of complicated things ahead. But amazing how everyone's trying to cleverly think about, do I do a pop-up restaurant? Do I get a few more tables outdoors? So everyone's desperate to get through it, but very interesting.
Well, and this is the thing that I really struck me there. When one of the restaurateurs was talking about, you know, ordinarily in a restaurant launch, we'd be looking at supply chain logistics 6 months out. with only 3 and a bit months in, and they've had to completely turn everything on its head. Do you think that there is something about, maybe it's the risk-taking appetite of people who are in the hospitality sector, that they're just better at being adaptable? Because all the conversation around the whole reopening of the wider economy is about stagnation and job losses and how do we get out of it. But so many of these people have this story of a really fearless approach. Is it a sector-specific thing, do you think?
Well, what's been incredible to watch is, you know, the number of people who have set up these takeaway services, you know, doing great meals to take home to keep their staff employed, keep their businesses going. The number of restaurants in London that became grocery stores, you know, pop-up, you know, cheese counters, delis, all sorts of things. I think that's kept going, which has also been important because then you have these community connections. You know, the restaurant that kept going and stayed connected, that's the one that you'll be rushing back to. So I think all of that is just fascinating.
It's fascinating and it's delicious. The Jacconi takeaway service is called Comfort and Joy. Andrew Muller mentioned it. Can I say, Andrew, I partook of it. I felt comforted and joyful as I was eating. So it does what it says on the box.
We've been there for our Christmas lunch, our little team. So we love that. And just one other interesting thing is that lots of the operations have to change because restaurants, they used to say, your table's not ready, stand at the bar. They'd make a little bit of money from you while you're standing at the bar. They can't do that anymore. They would say, queue outside. And you'd have queues at hip restaurants of 30, 40 people. They can't do that anymore. So they're taking bookings, they're doing wait lists, and they've got to be really much more on the operations side than ever before. And for some of these restaurants who have never done that, that's going to be quite complicated to get right tomorrow.
And Andrew, last word. Where is the tuck fast ending? There must be a specific place near your home.
Well, my fast is going to end next week, actually, not on Saturday, because Noble Rock, which is a great restaurant with a good wine magazine just around the corner from me, that they're up and running next week. And we've delayed to go next week. So that's going to be my first in-house experience. And my pomp partner's eaten some terrible meals from me. It would be very grateful to see something new on the plate.
I would love to know about Andrew Muller's home cooking. He alluded to it. I think we need a whole series to get into that. That's one for another day. Andrew Tuck, good to hear from you. As always, Monocle's editor, Andrew Tuck. Wrapping up the briefing, just time to tell you, Jean Castex has been named as France's new PM. We kicked off the show talking about that. He's a leading civil servant who orchestrated France's exit from lockdown. We'll have more on that and all the other stories through the day here on Monocle 24. But from your Friday briefing team, that is all. Goodbye and thank you very much for listening.